You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, while raising children in the middle of chickens and fields of crops might sound like a great childhood experience, many farmers are struggling with the workload of the farm and the needs of their children. We'll talk to a reporter about the challenges facing young families in the farming business. First, conservatives are calling a recent state Supreme Court decision a victory for academic freedom. On Friday, the court said Marquette University improperly suspended John McAdams, an associate professor of political science. In a November 2014 blog post, he criticized a student teacher for telling her class that because everybody agrees with gay rights, there's no reason to discuss it in the context of the class. He also linked to an article on her personal website. She received threats after that blog post. Marquette suspended McAdams without pay, saying his conduct, quote, painted a target, end quote, on the back of a graduate student. But in a 4-2 ruling, the state Supreme Court said McAdams' contract guaranteed academic freedom and ordered his reinstatement with back pay. In response, Marquette attorney Ralph Weber said the court took away the university's power to defend its students.
Private institutions need to have the ability to protect and enforce their mission-critical values. As a Catholic Jesuit university, Marquette's core values do not include professors cyberbullying students. So as a private institution, it's concerning that the court has stepped in this instance and prevented those core values from being defended.
In a statement, Marquette said it will consider revising its policies. John McAdams, the professor at the center of the story, joined us earlier today. John, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, it's been a few years since this all started. How does it feel now to ultimately have this verdict from the state's Supreme Court?
Well, it's some combination of elation and relief. It's just good to be sort of out of limbo, to have a resolution. It's been, 3.5 years of various proceedings, depositions, hearings, trials, and it's seemed to go on and on, so it was time for it to end.
Now, for you, apart from your personal career, what were the issues at stake for professors in this case?
Well, one was Marquette's contractual guarantee of free expression. Marquette not only guarantees faculty academic freedom, which you can sort of make it a vague concept if you want to, but they also guarantee all the rights of expression in the U.S. Constitution. That includes the First Amendment. That is pretty precise. The exceptions to free speech in the First Amendment, things like perjury or libel or incitement, are pretty precisely defined and very narrow. So that's a very strong protection for free expression.
Now, Marquette has argued during the case and since the ruling that this wasn't about academic freedom and free speech, but a kind of a workplace issue involving their mission to protect the students. In this case, they say protecting a student, a graduate teaching assistant, from harassment. What do you say to their argument along those lines?
Well, if you call my blog post harassment, then any journalism constitutes harassment. Interesting that they talk about protecting students, because I was protecting an undergraduate in this graduate instructor's class. She wasn't a mere teaching assistant, which might imply, oh, she just ran discussion sections. She was the instructor of record in the course. She'd taught it several times before. From the standpoint of the student, she was the professor, and she pretty much demeaned him for simply wanting to express opposition to gay marriage. So it's interesting that Marquette seems to want to protect an abusive graduate instructor and not an undergraduate. The Department of Philosophy chair referred to the undergraduate as an insolent little twerp. And told him he needed to change his attitude. He, in effect, was harassed.
And Marquette had also said in a statement that if you had brought up the issue, not mentioned the student instructor by name, not linking to the personal site, which, given the way the internet works, I think they were saying that opened the door to harassment, they might have reacted differently. What's your response?
Well, the fact that I named her and she got some unkind email gave them a pretext for trying to get rid of me, although I think they'd wanted to do that a long time. I've hung out a lot of Marquette's dirty linen. First of all, two things. Number one, I did not link to her contact information. I linked to an essay on her site about how all men are responsible for the prevalence of rape. I did that, and frankly, to show the sort of person she is. You know, all men, your dad, your brother, cops who arrest rapists, yeah. On that essay was not any contact information. Had someone dug around her publicly accessible blog, it was about three clicks, if you knew where to click, yeah, you could find her email address. But I didn't link to any page that had her email address. Number two, standard journalism involves when you are talking about someone's misconduct, you use their name. Several days ago, remember, a congressional intern shot out in the vicinity of Donald Trump in the Capitol Rotunda. You can search that issue on, say, Google News. Her name was Caitlin Marriott, and you'll find that essentially every article that discusses that names her. That's normal journalistic practice, in spite of the fact that she was an intern with no authority over anyone. And Cheryl Abate, the graduate instructor I named, was the instructor of record in the class. She was in a position of authority over her students. So, yeah, you know, Marquette, in fact, has sort of concocted something there.
Talking to political scientist John McAdams from Marquette University about a recent Supreme Court ruling in a case involving him and the university, issues of academic freedom and free speech. John, if this case had gone the other way, what would be your concerns for employees of universities, faculty in particular?
Well, here's an important thing to remember. At Marquette, a private university does not have to guarantee academic freedom, but Marquette does in its contracts with faculty. Most reputable private universities do. That's what they need to do to attract good faculty. At public institutions, they are inherently protected by the First Amendment. If Marquette could weasel around those protections by claiming after the fact that I shouldn't have put up that blog post, notwithstanding that I didn't break any rule, that there was no precedent saying that I couldn't, they just judged after the fact that I had been quote-unquote reckless, then First Amendment protections, either in the public sector for state schools or private schools that guarantee it in their contracts, it wouldn't mean much. You could simply, after the fact, if there was some expression you didn't like from a professor, judge that, well, this was somehow unprofessional or uncollegial or reckless or whatever. So it would largely vitiate the protection that the faculty have. Happily, with this particular outcome, which, by the way, is not binding on federal courts or not binding on state courts anywhere but Wisconsin, but yes, lawyers do cite cases from other states. It does matter.
Do you feel that you were treated in a particular way here because of your partisan political beliefs?
Yes and no, okay? A lot of conservatives, I'm actually a sort of a libertarian politically, but a conservative socially, a lot of conservatives on college campuses keep their heads down. So if I'd been a conservative who kept his head down, I would have probably been okay. If I'd been a conservative who maybe voiced conservative opinions but didn't criticize things going on at the institution, I probably would have been okay. But anyone who checks my blog starting in 2005 will see I often criticize Marquette's bureaucrats for what they do. So I think that was it, not just being a conservative. and not entirely just being an outspoken conservative, but being someone who is willing to hang out Marquette's dirty laundry.
People listening who might work in a private business might say, hey, if I started a blog criticizing my employer, they'd soon be my ex-employer. Why are universities different when it comes to, say, a faculty's right to criticize bite the hand that feeds them, I guess?
Well, number one, faculties. Universities generally, even private universities that could restrict speech, usually provide for faculty a contractual guarantee of free speech. Joe's sheet metal probably doesn't do that. If you're Joe's employee and criticize Joe, he'll probably fire you. Although Joe could guarantee his employees free speech in their contracts if he wanted to, but he pretty much never wants to. Universities are all about speech. Why, you know, there's no particular reason somebody working in Joe's sheet metal shop particularly needs to, you know, speak out against Joe or speak out about political topics. Since universities are all about speech, having a robust norm of free speech is particularly appropriate in universities. And, of course, leftists at Marquette have sometimes been quite outspoken criticizing the university. When the university, for example, started to hire and then didn't hire a lesbian arts and science dean in 2010, a lot of faculty spoke out in opposition to that, signed petitions, bought an ad in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, et cetera. In other words, they spoke out and they had every right to do that.
Looking ahead, when are you going to be back in the classroom?
That's still up in the air, certainly no later than next spring. It's kind of late to schedule me for the fall, but that's not entirely impossible. We'll see. I mean, that's the sort of thing that gets hashed out between my lawyers and officials at Marquette.
Somebody came and asked you, hey, John, should I send my kid to Marquette? What do you tell them?
That's a complicated question. I have a lot more reservations about that than I would have 20 or 30 years ago. Not only is Marquette more politically correct, but Marquette has radically watered down the curriculum. You can graduate from Marquette under the new, quote-unquote, reformed curriculum with only one course in philosophy, one course in theology, no history courses. If you get a Bachelor of Arts that traditionally has had a foreign language requirement, you know, it's two semesters where it used to be four. So I would frankly have some reservations about making a strong recommendation. Sometimes people ask me, if you don't think so well of Marquette, why do you want to go back? The answer is the students who do come there are pretty good. It's quite enjoyable to teach those students. So, yeah, I'll be back.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
John McAdams is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. We talked with him about last week's state Supreme Court ruling that the school improperly suspended him after he criticized a graduate student instructor on his blog and linked to her personal website. First, while the idea of raising kids on the farm might sound healthy and full of fresh air, a lot of farmers are realizing that caring for their children and taking care of their farm duties are two different full-time jobs. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up on a farm? How did your parents manage? Are you a farmer now who has kids or considering kids? Is this an issue, childcare, that worries you? You can join us at 800-642-1234. Danielle Berteau is a journalist based in New York. Her work on science, technology, and food has appeared in the New York Times, Entrepreneur, and elsewhere. Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, as you write, a lot of people have concerns with childcare, especially affordable childcare. Can you talk about some of the specific challenges that farm families are finding these days?
Sure. There's a lot. One probably is the most obvious thing is that working in and living in a rural community, there are often just not a lot of options for any type of care at all, not just what we would consider a gold standard of care. So that's one thing. Another is, of course, that farmers have schedules that don't really conform to what we think of a typical sort of 9-to-5 job or school season schedule. So right now, for example, I'm sure many of your listeners are extremely busy with summer season, and they are going to be working really long days and need more care in the summer than they might need in the winter. And those are two things that came up a lot when I was talking to farmers about this issue.
And a lot of people might have that sort of idyllic, you know, oh, back in the day, everybody on the farm with the extended family. There might have been different alternatives for childcare in the old days, whatever they were, than there are now.
Sure. Although, let's not romanticize that too much.
Sure.
But sure, I mean, and today, so we're looking at people who maybe they're starting farms in communities where they don't have a family and friend network, at least initially. Maybe they're in a situation where they are continuing with the family farm tradition, but a lot of the family members have off-farm jobs, which just for economic survival these days is really common. And so they don't have the extended family member group who is actually available to take care of the kids. And so we're just looking at that big shift, but these ideas about sort of how do you treat childcare when you're in an agricultural community haven't changed to adapt to that.
And you, as part of this story, you interviewed farm families in Wisconsin and elsewhere around the country. And I've been saying farm families, but you found this really, really falls to a huge extent on the moms.
Sure. And my initial research into this story was not focused just on female farmers. But that was what I found again and again. And I spoke to many more people than actually I ended up quoting in the piece just first because of space issues. Along with, I think similarly to other families in the countries, that women do end up spending more of their time on average, looking after their children. And that is definitely what I heard from these female farmers, is that this expectation is that they're going to do and also continue farming at the same time. And for some of them, it wasn't until they were actually trying to do that that they found out that it was really, really difficult.
What kind of solutions, ad hoc solutions, did you find families, moms in particular, coming up with?
I've heard since this piece was published from a lot more people, and some of them had these really, really interesting solutions. One was talking about building a little child pen in one of their barns, I believe. Another was talking about how one of their children, when they were toddlers, really didn't like grass. And so she would put a blanket outside and he would stay on the blanket. And that was sort of a, you know, invisible fence, as it were, for that particular child. And in the story, I mentioned, you know, families who figure out a barter system where it's sort of like they're getting a CSA share for taking care of a farmer's kids for X amount of hours a week. And just trying to figure out, you know, people on Facebook's, you know, groups saying, hey, I need some childcare for a few hours tomorrow. Is anybody available? And so really just trying to deal with it as it comes.
I want to bring on a caller now. Jackie is with us in Hillsboro. Jackie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Jackie?
I farm with my family in Hillsboro, and we milk 820 cows. Between my sister and I, we have 6 kids, ages 11 and under, and they're on the farm with us every single day. And our farm, it's like they say it takes a village to raise children. Well, it takes an entire farm to raise these kids, because everyone is well aware that there's kids running around. They're very conscious when they're driving things. When, you know, I had a guy have to stop from pushing up feed this morning because I had the stroller parked in the feed alley. So he stops, moves the stroller so he can push up feed. Everyone is very aware. Kids that are raised on the farm come with a very strong work ethic. And while it is a challenge on a daily basis to get your work done, I think it's very important that your kids see you working to feed the world with what you do. And I really wouldn't trade it.
Jackie, thanks a lot for the call. So she likes this, but it sounds like a lot of work and multiple people involved, Danielle.
Sure. And I think one of the things I tried to do in the piece was present a variety of situations. So we had some larger production farms and we had somebody who was homesteading. And people, and I totally understand this, they want to have their kids outside with them and learning about farming. And, you know, I think that's really great and admirable. I think that having more some choice, however, and some flexibility about childcare is something a lot of farming families would really appreciate, which would mean that maybe, you know, the kids aren't with you all the time, but they're with you sometimes because you have somewhere else to take them where they're getting some sort of stimulation, you know, stimulating environment. They're there for a few hours a week. I don't think this is a sort of all or nothing decision. But that's what's sort of lacking, right? There's a lack of choice about, you know, what do you do with these kids? Do you have that flexibility?
And briefly, Danielle, this is an issue that we've talked to people about, a lack of younger farmers, people not being there to take over farms as farmers retire. Is this one of the stumbling blocks for a lot of people?
That's what I'm hearing. And definitely, you know, I think it's sort of interesting. We have this conversation, you know, not just with agricultural communities, but, you know, there are these, there was a study that actually the New York Times did in response to sort of lowering birth rates. And the first thing that came up for respondents of families who had already had children on why they weren't going to have more children, the first thing was daycare. The first thing was childcare. It was 64% said that the expense of childcare was keeping them from having more kids. You couple that with the uncertain economics of farming, especially for newer farmers who are starting out and, you know, they're trying to get their operation growing, they're trying to grow their business to where they want it. I mean, that's hard, right? That's really hard and often in financially unstable thing to do. So that's an extra burden for them.
Well, Danielle, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Danielle Berteaux is a journalist based in New York. We've been talking about her reporting on the challenges facing farm families and not having access to a lot of childcare help. Now, immigration in the United States stirs up passionate debate on both sides of the issue, and the political debate over immigration, legal or otherwise, can sometimes be difficult to follow. All this week on Central Time, we're taking a closer look at the issues at play in the immigration debate. Today, we're looking at the laws in the United States that dictate who can settle here, how they're approved, and the hurdles in place for people who want to come to the United States. Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law and focuses on immigration and citizenship. He's also the author of two books on the subject, including Americans in Waiting and Immigration Outside the Law. Hiroshi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of immigration in the United States and the numbers, the rough numbers of people who are coming here?
Sure. Well, in the recent years, about 1 million people have been allowed lawfully to become so-called lawful permanent residents of the United States. That's the people we think of as immigrants. And the lion's share of those folks are brought in or allowed to come in based on their family relationships. There are also people who come in to work. There are people who are coming in as refugees or getting political asylum, and there are people who come in under a lottery system that we have. It adds up to about 1 million people per year, so you can scale that against the U.S. population, which is about, 330 million right now.
And looking at charts of immigration, the raw numbers of immigrants have gone up a lot in the last few decades as compared to the past, but compared to the 1880s to 1920s, we're a little lower as a percentage of the population. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, the period that you're talking about around the time that we think of as the heyday of Ellis Island, around 1900, give or take a decade or two. Yeah, at that time, you had a foreign-born population of the United States of about 15% of the country. It's been creeping up toward that number since about 1970, which is a modern low, and it's been creeping up to that, but it hasn't hit historic highs in terms of percentages. Of course, as you say, the absolute numbers are high because the percentage of because the population in the United States is larger.
Talk us through the process of someone who wants to immigrate to the United States legally. And setting aside refugees and asylum seekers now, we'll be talking about that more later in the week. But I guess what we'd think of as straight up old fashioned moving to the United States.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the best way to think about it is that there are four basic ways to get to the United States legally. in order to become what's called a lawful permanent resident. In other words, these are immigrants. I'm going to leave aside now people who come as students, come as temporary visitors, temporary workers, that kind of thing. But just focusing on people we think of as really immigrating to the country and becoming eligible to become citizens eventually, there are four basic categories. You have about 70% of the people coming in based on family relationships, which I can subdivide in a second. But just to give you an overview, there's about 12% of the immigrants are coming in based on work. About 13% of the people come in either as refugees or they get asylum in this country. And then we have a lottery that allows about 4% of the country to come in. And that adds up to your million, give or take, 100,000 or so in the last few years. And so the way it works is that someone has to file paperwork to qualify. They typically require someone to sponsor them in the sense of filing a petition for them. So let's say, for example, you're a U.S. citizen, you marry someone who's not legally in the United, not legally, let's say you marry them overseas, then that you have to petition for them, prove the relationship, and file a petition. Depending on the category, there may or may not be a waiting period. It really depends. Some of the more attenuated family relationships, like brothers and sisters, the waiting periods are over 20 years right now. It also depends on what country you're from, or I should say what country you were born in, how long you might have to wait.
Let's talk about the lottery a little bit. That's gotten some attention in the political world lately, and it sounds, I mean, the word lottery sounds like just some sort of very random process. Can you talk about the lottery portion of immigration?
Well, it is a random process in the sense it's literally a lottery. I mean, you millions of people apply, and about 50,000 people are picked every year, and they're allowed to come in. You're only allowed to apply for the lottery if you're from a country that has not sent a lot of immigrants to the United States recently. So this was originally adopted about a generation ago as a way to restore immigration from Western Europe, which had actually declined in the period from, let's say, the 1960s, 1980s. And it was really initially adopted to try to preserve some avenues for European immigration. But what's actually happened is it's become much more diverse over the last generation. A lot of African immigrants, for example, have been successful lottery applicants, winners, I suppose you could say. And so that amounts to It really amounts to just 4% of the people that we land into the country, about 50,000 a year. There's some fairly minimal education requirements, but generally speaking, this really is a lottery, and it's the lucky people who get in. But as I said, it's not every country that can apply. That is, not people from every country can apply. You have to be from only certain countries.
Hiroshi Motomura is with us from the UCLA School of Law. We're looking at immigration law in the United States, kicking off a week-long series looking at immigration-related issues. Hiroshi, let's turn for a moment to illegal immigration. Do we have a sense of, I know this is a little harder to track in terms of numbers, but the scope of illegal immigration and how much of it is what we think of, you know, people crossing the border illegally versus people, say, overstaying that student or temporary work visa?
Yeah, those are really important questions you're asking. The best estimates we have, and they're demographers that specialize in this type of estimate, because as you say, it's not as if you really can be 100% sure, but we're looking at something like 10 million people in the country, maybe 11 million people in the country who are here without lawful status. And you raise an important question about exactly how they got to be here in unlawful or illegal undocumented status. Roughly half, it's really hard to say, roughly half of them overstayed a visa after being lawfully admitted. They lawfully overstayed, and maybe up to half, it's hard to know, came across the border without being inspected. That's the technical term. So that's a significant number. I think one of the things that's interesting about this is that if you had asked me this question maybe 5-10 years ago, I would have told you that the number of people coming in illegally to the United States might be a few hundred thousand a year, and so it would be a significant percentage of people coming in legally. I think that's changed quite a bit. There's been a lot more enforcement, especially at the border. This is true not just currently, but also under the Obama administration. And so I think that the numbers have subsided somewhat, and the number of border crossings has actually dropped dramatically. And as I mentioned, this was true under Obama as well.
There's a lot of argument. One of the biggest points of debate is what happens to people who are here illegally. what is there currently a path to a permanent legal status for someone who is currently in the United States illegally?
Yeah, well, that's something that a lot of people who are in the country unlawfully are in a position to take advantage of. Let's say, for example, you are in the country, maybe you overstayed a visa, maybe you walked across the border, or let's say you marry a U.S. citizen. Then you'd qualify as a spouse of a U.S. citizen. You'd qualify to get a green card, and some years later, you'd qualify to become a U.S. citizen, or you'd be eligible to naturalize. Can you do that? There are other hurdles besides just being qualified by virtue of marriage. You have to have your sponsor, who'd be your husband or wife, file an affidavit guaranteeing financial support, for example. And it's not always clear that you'll be able to actually qualify to get a green card. You get some really strange complications here, but not everyone who's in the United States unlawfully marries a U.S. citizen can stay in the country and get a green card. Some people are not eligible to do that without leaving the country. Once they leave the country, they may not be able to come back for 3 years or possibly for 10 years. So I'm just scratching the surface of some complications here. But the bottom line is, yes, you can. There's a lot of people who marry U.S. citizens and are able to legalize their status. But a lot of people, for various technical reasons, cannot.
A huge question that we could spend a whole segment on. I'll just ask it to you in one question. There's a lot of debate over the economic impact of legal and illegal immigrants, their impact on jobs for people who are already citizens. Some people making the case that we need more immigrants to do a lot of the jobs with an aging population. Big picture, do you have a sense of the economic impact?
Well, you know, this is a really important question, and it's complicated enough that economists have built careers on this question. But I think it really comes down to this. There's a lot of, I think, a consensus that if you look at the economy as a whole, it helps quite a bit to have immigrants because they help grow the economy in terms of allowing enterprises to stay in the United States. They create demand for goods and services. The difficulty is that the winners or the gains from immigration are not necessarily evenly spread out. And so there might be a lot of people who are much better off economically, including keeping their jobs because they're immigrants coming in. But there are a few people who are going to be displaced and are going to suffer. And so a lot of the challenge, I think, for policymakers is to try to take those gains that you see across the economy and the country as a whole and to channel those to people, to whether it's job retraining or educational access, to those who are going to be hurt in some way. I think overall the people hurt are not as numerous as the people who are helped, but I don't mean to diminish the hardship that it can cause. It's also true in terms of tax revenues because, as a general matter, you've got a lot of federal revenues coming in on the basis of people working without papers, but they're paying the Social Security, they're getting income tax withheld. They may not get that back. That's a net gain for the federal government, but there are localities around the country that may have higher educational costs, for example, and they're not necessarily getting that fully compensated by the federal government. So the bottom line is immigration helps economically, but I think the country as a policy matter has challenges to try to spread the wealth to make sure that we reduce the number of people who lose out.
We're talking to Hiroshi Motomura right now, professor at the UCLA School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship. He's with us today to give us a quick lesson in immigration laws here in the United States. And we're taking your questions. If you have one, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What question do you have about immigration and immigration law as it currently stands in the United States? What do you find confusing about the laws? What do you want to know more about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about immigration law in the United States with Hiroshi Motomura. He is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship issues. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What is confusing to you about immigration laws and policies here in the United States? Is there something you could use some clarification on, a question that has been nagging at you, maybe based on what you've seen in the news or heard on this show? call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Owen is with us in Wauwega. Owen, hi.
Hey, good afternoon, Rob. Thanks a lot for taking my call today. And so as a beginning young dairy farmer here in Wisconsin, I'm competing against these large economic model dairy farms that believe in an economy as a scale, but 90% of their workforce is not eligible to vote. Now, some of those might be H-2A work visas, some of them might be using the H-2C work visas, and some of them might not be legal at all for different reasons, like the guest spoke about earlier. So the question that I have is, because these people aren't voters, what is that doing to the representation of the farming community here in this country when people like me are trying to operate in a manner that's legal and competing against people who don't have legal citizens who can't vote, creating their wealth for them?
Owen, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. First, can you talk about those couple categories of legal work, I guess work visas, Hiroshi, that would allow people to come in and work on the dairy farms legally?
Yeah, sure. When you asked earlier about who's allowed to come in, I was focusing on people who come in to be immigrants in the sense to become eligible for citizenship a few years down the road. As the caller says, he's absolutely right, that there are different categories for people to come in legally to work on a temporary basis. And some of them are agricultural, some are not agricultural. There are a lot of people coming in IT, computer fields. And so those categories are significant. And the caller's right that these are people who are not allowed to vote. I mean, one thing I should say is that, you know, the people living, let's say you're foreign born in your country, you could be here temporarily. You certainly wouldn't be allowed to vote. With a few exceptions around the country. If you're here as a green card holder, you're not allowed to vote. That a green card holder is the permanent resident. It's only when you become a citizen that you're allowed to vote. And so there is this sense that in some communities, you've got a lot of people living without being able to exercise. They don't have the right to vote. This is true throughout the country. I guess it's true in the farming communities that your caller is talking about. It's also true, certainly, in a lot of large cities.
Owen also mentioned his concerns about non-legal workers, in this case at dairy farmers. What kind of enforcement and laws are there for employers?
Well, it's been illegal since 1986 for U.S. employers to hire or to continue to hire people who are not authorized to work. And so you have people, there's a process a lot of anyone's gone through in this country if they've gotten any new job since 1986, filling out paperwork. The tricky thing about this is that when Congress adopted this in 1986, they created a system that was actually pretty easy to get around in certain ways. There are a lot of false documents floating around out there. And so that's a lot of what I think the call is referring to with regard to people working when they shouldn't be. But, you know, the policy angle of this is that throughout the history of the United States, certainly in the history of the entire 20th century, the U.S. economy has really had what seems to be an insatiable thirst for workers, whether they're in the country legally or not. And so there's been a lot of times in U.S. history throughout the whole 20th century when Congress has decided that we're going to make it look like it's hard to work illegally, but in fact we're going to create a system where there's a lot of looking the other way. And that's quite a bit of how we got to the mess we're in now, where we have a lot of people who are in the country unlawfully. Depends on how you kind of think about that, but certainly they've been put in a very exploited situation as well. So there's a lot of blame to go around here.
Owen, thanks for your call. We're talking about immigration and immigration law with Hiroshi Motomura from the UCLA School of Law. Back to your calls now. Karen is with us in Spooner. Karen, hi.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having this conversation today. It's really important. I heard that there was a recent ruling by the Trump administration that disallowed for people who are illegally, like, for instance, on student visas, to remain. For instance, if a student has to go in and make a change of address moving off campus, they may go in and find themselves deported. I mean, there's so much going on right now in regards to people who are in an immigrant status that I don't know if the conversation is actually about the word immigrant anymore and is moving along to something different. I think that we are shifting the whole idea of what this is.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. So are people, Hiroshi, maybe thinking they're here in a legal way, going in to fill out paperwork or something like that? Karen gave us an example, and finding themselves deported.
Well, a couple things that come to mind here. One is that immigration law is unbelievably complicated, and there are a lot of people who are in a gray area. And a gray area, for example, would be that someone was a student, they transferred and started school at another location without getting permission. They would be technically unlawfully in the United States at that point. But let's say they marry a U.S. citizen, like the scenario you gave earlier. So they figure, well, okay, I'm qualified to marry a U.S. citizen. That's the way you're supposed to do it. You go in. So at that point, the office, there's different possibilities here. One is that if you're going to really apply the letter of the law, the person's, as they say, out of status, and they could be subject to deportation. The other way to do it is say, look, you're in line. We're going to exercise our discretion and realize that you're going to get a green card. I think what we've seen in this administration is much more of a propensity to do the hardline approach. And so that's why you're getting some stories of people going into what they thought were fairly routine check-ins or even applying for status and then finding themselves put in a situation where they might even be put in detention at that point. So I think what you're really seeing is more of a hard line on enforcement these days, and it's coming up in some cases where before the discretion was exercised to say, you know, you're in line, you're on your way to green card status, we're going to let you do it.
Thanks a lot for that call. As we start to wrap up, Hiroshi, are there any main misconceptions about immigration that you want to set the record straight about, whether it's what we've covered so far or not?
Well, I mean, there's one thing that's within a lot of what we talked about, and that is that a lot of people, I hear often, you know, why don't they stand in line? And the fact of the matter is the system the Congress set up in the 1960s made it very difficult to come to this country to work unless you have a college degree. But the fact of the matter is that employers and just the economy really needs a lot of workers who don't have college degrees. And I hesitate to call them unskilled. They're often highly skilled. They just don't have college degrees. And so what's happened is we created a system that we sort of invite them to come here, look the other way, and then every once in a while the politics or the politicians demand heavy enforcement. I think that the misconception is that there's a line to stand in for workers without college degrees. I think one of the big things that the country needs to do is to try to align the needs of the economy with categories that will supply the labor. But at the same time, and this gets back to another thing you said, I think it's at the same time it's important to make sure that the gains to those companies from those workers are spread out and apply to things that provide some economic comfort to the people who might feel that their jobs are in jeopardy.
Hiroshi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, also the author of two books on the subject of immigration, Americans in Waiting and Immigration Outside the Law. He joined us with a lesson in U.S. immigration law and how it impacts who can come and stay in America. We continue our series on immigration at this time tomorrow when we look at the history of immigration in the U.S. with UW historian Cindy Ifen Cheng and find out how attitudes toward immigration and immigrants have changed over time.